This is Dr. David Stevens, your host on Christian Doctor's Digest. You know, putting these together and doing the interviews is just one of my favorite things to do because I get to talk to some very interesting people on important topics. In fact, I was thinking of that this weekend as I was in a church in Michigan where I had the missions conference, was the main speaker. I first went there in 1984 as a young missionary, and my dad actually started that conference, first mission speaker in 1976, and it was like a family reunion. And what do you do at a family reunion? You have lots of good food, and the ladies in this church, we had two or three potlucks, and it was wonderful. Well, this issue of Christian Doctor's Digest is your potluck with interviews. We're going to start with Pat George, the head of Valley Hope Rehab, talking about the opioid epidemic and how that's impacting our country and giving us some great advice on where we can find help for people that are fighting this addiction. Bob Bowers is going to join us and talk about missions. He was a missionary in Ethiopia during the Marxist time in that country. Very, very difficult time, hostile as it was in an Islamic country. And we're going to talk about how to do missions under those circumstances. And then John Patrick and John Robson will join us to talk about how to present the gospel to intelligent unbelievers, atheists, agnostics, who are going to really fence with you on the issues. And they've got some great insights. So, man, I'm excited to get to the table, got my plate out, ready to receive some good things. Let's get to that first interview. You know, it's a delight to introduce to you Pat George, who's president and CEO of the Valley Hope Association, been there since 2015, but before that he served on the board of directors since 2003. Pat has a very long and distinguished career in business and public service. He was in the Kansas House of Representatives for 6 years and then was the Kansas Commerce Secretary from 2010 to 2015 under Governor Sam Brownback. Pat also has a 25-year track record of starting and building successful business ventures. He took over his family's very successful automobile dealership. He did real estate development, professional sports. He says this is the best job, though, he's ever had, and he's going to share some of that with you. Interestingly, Valley Hope was started by one of our members, Lynn Collop. Lynn was on the board when I came to CMDA in 1994, was our treasurer and a dear friend, been very involved in CMDA for his whole lifetime, and started this wonderful ministry to deal with addictions in the small little town of Norton, Kansas, way out in the middle of nowhere, and now it's across the country. Let's hear what Pat has to say. Pat, it's great to welcome you to Christian Doctor's Digest, and I just wanted to get together with you and talk a little about the opioid epidemic, other drugs that people are using, alcohol, and then you're the head of a wonderful ministry outreach, Valley Hope, which literally is all over the western part of the United States and through electronic means all over the country. And our doctors are dealing with these patients every day. Kind of give us an overview of how you're seeing things in our country, how they're changing, and some of the helps that are out there to help people deal with this.
Well, Dave, first of all, thanks for having me on and the kind words about Valley Hope. Valley Hope, actually, we celebrated 50 years last weekend and had a large turnout here in Norton, Kansas, which is in the northwest part of the state, and it's where we began 50 years ago. And it's to me, it's a divine inspiration is the reason we got started. There's two guys, a young medical doctor and a young minister that cared enough about a guy that a friend of theirs that was drinking himself to death that they pursued and looked around, and you know, back in the 60s we didn't have Google and all the tools that we have today, and so it took some effort, and finally they found someone that was having some luck working with alcoholics, and from that beginning of caring for someone, we've expanded into seven states. We have 16 facilities and have treated over 300,000 people over 50 years. And it's an amazing story. You can see the hand of God in about every step that we've taken. And to this day, we treat alcoholism and addiction kind of a three-legged approach of the mind, body, and the spirit. And, and that separates us from a lot of other treatment centers out there. And I am a Valley Hope product myself. I recently celebrated 25 years of being clean and sober. And my father was one of the first patients back in 1968. So
Our
family has been involved for many, many years with Valley Hope. And then a couple years ago was asked if I would be interested in this position. And it's pretty hard to turn down the entity that saved your life. And, and so now I'm blessed to work with, we have almost 700 associates around the country that are part of the Valley Hope team. And I tell my friends, I say, there's a lot of cool jobs out there, but I don't know if there's anything cooler than helping save lives and save families. And that's what we do on a daily basis. And
our members should be interested to know that doctor was a CMDA member, Lynn Collip. Some people would know Lynn. He's a retired physician now up in his 80s, and I've actually visited their Valley Hope and know the terrific outreach you have. Let people know a little bit about your background. You talked about, you know, your 25 years of sobriety, but you've had a rather distinguished career before you moved over to Valley Hope, and a lot of it in the government arena.
Yeah, I think I look back over my life and see how really the Lord's had his hand in preparing me to be in this position. I started out, my father was a Buick GMC dealer for many years in Dodge City, Kansas, and I followed in his footsteps. So I was in the car business for a number of years and also ventured into a lot of other businesses, rental property, and even had a steak company at one time. And then was on the way to the gym at 5 in the morning and needed some gas. So I was putting a little gas in my car, and a friend of mine came out and said, oh, I've been wanting to get a hold of you. There's a position that I think you ought to run for in state government. And I kept pumping the gas, and he asked if I heard him, and I said, no, I didn't hear you, and I don't want to hear you. And then 2 hours later, a good friend of mine that's a minister called up and said, hey, I ran into Dave. He said, you're going to run for this position. I said, no, I'm not going to run for it. But anyway, one thing led to another, and I was very fortunate to serve 5 years in the Kansas legislature, and then Governor Sam Brownback, a very dear friend of mine, and devout Christian, asked if I would serve as the Secretary of Commerce, and I was able to do that for 5 years until the Valley Hope CEO position opened up. And, you know, all of those things, I was just blessed to be in a position that opened up a bigger world to me, and I could understand how maybe the pieces go together a little bit, you know, work better in a certain position. And so now to be at the head of an organization that is spread out across 7 states and have different facilities, it just, you know, a blessing that the Lord put me in a position to be prepared to move this entity forward. Even though we've been around 50 years and we've treated a lot of people, unfortunately, the need's probably greater today than it ever has been, and you can't open up a newspaper or turn on the TV without hearing about the opioid epidemic, and it's something that we are very aware of every day. It certainly presents some different challenges than other addictions. You know, the basic underlying causes and symptoms are the same, but some of the challenges that are inherent to the opioid addiction are that we're seeing a younger cohort of people that check into our facilities, and with that comes some challenges in itself. That you know, in their 20s, still maturing, one of the biggest factors that we deal with is that they really don't have any roots. Typically, when you're in your early 20s, you know, you probably don't have a family, you don't have a home, you don't have a career that you've spent any amount of time with. So those things help, you know, when you're working with someone that's has the disease of addiction, if they have something that you can focus on that, you know, help them get through the day, and typically the younger people don't have that yet. So we've modified the way that we treat people based on that, and it's all walks of life that we're seeing with this opioid epidemic. And you know, many times we have several medical doctors on our board, and of course Dr. Lynn Collip, emeritus status, but you know, they're not given a lot of training when it comes to addiction. I think it's picked up some here recently, but what we found is just the education part. We are joined the hospital association in all the states that we're in, and we have a group of folks that make presentation that at the different regional meetings that they have, as well as doctor groups and dental groups.
Well, and unfortunately, the healthcare profession has been complicit in the opioid epidemic, and a lot of focus on that and making sure, even though you may have good intentions, that you're not giving too large a prescriptions, you're not giving narcotics when they're not needed and something else will work, and that you're not being fooled by people coming in and asking for medications that are getting them from multiple places, and all sorts of systems, as you know, going in place in states across the country. I know here in Tennessee, where I am, there's a central registry where every narcotic prescription is registered, and you can go in and find out whether a patient's been abusing and all sorts of things. So it's a huge battle that Clear Up to the federal government we're working on. Tell us a little bit more about your treatment facilities and the process. I think our members would like to hear the inside of what goes on when, for example, one of them would refer someone to one of your facilities. What happens?
Yes. First of all, let me valleyhope.org. If you have a loved one or friend that needs some help, lots of information on our website, valleyhope.org, or our 800 phone number is 800-544-5101. And that is a very good question, Dave, because most people don't know what goes on, and there's always a fear. I know the first time I went to treatment, kind of in my mind, I thought I was going to be locked up somewhere, maybe in a straitjacket, and go back to the beginning of Valley Hope. And the first executive director, the gentleman that Dr. Collip and Reverend Adams sought out, Dr. William Leopold, he had a novel approach. You know, back in the 60s, I remember because my father, I was a young kid, mom would tell us that dad was locked up for a few days in jail, or maybe he was in the hospital again, and that's kind of how they treated alcoholism, thought some kind of magic was going to happen if they, you know, just could spend a few days in the hospital or behind bars. And Dr. William Leopold thought that what an alcoholic needed more than anything was love. And they didn't possess the ability to give or receive love. And so the founding of Valley Hope was based on that every person deserves love and deserves respect. And you know, an alcoholic and an addict is not the most lovable person. And, somehow we've been able to hold on to that foundation for 50 years. And so when you come to one of our facilities, I would equate it more to checking into a hotel. There's no bars. There's, you're not locked in. Based on your time there, we restrict people to the grounds to begin with, just for their own safety. But, we let them leave for support group meetings, AA, NA, if they need to run down to the store to get some supplies, and we're also try to teach responsibility. I remember when I first came to treatment, they said the most important thing you can bring is your alarm clock, and I thought that was kind of odd, but what it was is that, when it's time to get up and get to breakfast and get on with the day, we're not going to come around and cater to you. We expect you to be responsible enough. And so a typical day is the breakfast is served at 7. There's a voluntary chapel service at 7:40. And then at 8:05, we have what's called communications. It's just, introduce maybe new people that have checked in. You get your assignments for the day, meetings with your counselor or something unique to Valley Hope. You're not only assigned a counselor, but also a chaplain when you check in. And so those meetings are ongoing while you're in treatment. Of course, we do a physical exam and make sure physically that you're, able to, take part in the daily activities. And it's pretty normal, I'd say 99% of the people that come to see us, if you think of addiction as mild, medium, and severe, most of the people that show up here are from the extreme medium to severe case. So to spend some time in a recovery detox room where 24/7 nursing is available, and there could be some medications that are administered during this time to help with the detox process, which is the doctors that are listening to this will know firsthand, but it can actually be life-threatening in itself. And so you might be in detox for 24, 48 hours, or with some of the heavier addictions to opioids and even alcohol. Alcohol can be deadly, the withdrawal from it, that you might spend a week in the recovery room. And then from there, you're given a room. Most of our rooms are, you share that with someone else, and think of a typical motel room. And there's the activity that goes on where lectures and meeting with counselors and chaplains, but there's also a lot of interaction with the patient group. We subscribe to a milieu philosophy of our patient group being as important as the counselors and the other people that are involved. And it's very interesting, very touching, that we do a graduation ceremony after you've spent, it used to be kind of a standard 25 to 30 days. One of our challenges is working with our payers, the insurance companies, and I know our audience probably shaking their head. I know that they, every day battle that too, but they keep wanting to pay us for less days, and particularly with the opioid crisis affecting younger people, we're pushing for more days. But when you do graduate, we call it a cup hanging, and that goes way back almost 50 years. That, 50 years ago, we didn't have styrofoam cups or paper cups. You're given a porcelain coffee cup and a white porcelain cup, and over the years, people started decorating those, and it's turned out to be a real personal thing. You might have the name of your kids or your favorite Bible verse or, picture of the rising sun, but at your graduation ceremony, you hang that on the wall in the lecture room, and then you're asked to come back and pick that up in a year's time. But this graduation ceremony is a very emotional time, and what I always have a little tear in my eye, because when I am able to take part in those, not only do you see the counselors and the chaplains, but you'll see the cooks and the maintenance people. Everybody feels like they're part of the Valley Hope family and are contributing to the spiritual and the physical well-being of the patients that come into our facilities.
Tell about the spiritual ministry. You've touched on that with the chaplain being assigned, and because, there's other secular rehabs out there, but the spiritual component, how helpful have you found that to be? And then take a minute, just tell a story about an anonymous patient, and because I think nothing impacts people more than hearing the real-life incident of what happened.
Sure. For me personally, I think the spiritual aspect is the most important. Not only in what we do, but in healthcare, it might be the holy grail. We keep looking for ways to bend the cost curve down. And I had a great conversation actually with my former boss, the governor, and we were talking how, we prescribe medication for a lot of things that in the olden days, the prescription was get on our knees and pray.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of truth in that, but we embrace, we're non-denominational and kind of like the philosophy of Alcoholics Anonymous, where it talks about a spiritual awakening and a belief in a higher power, and and you're free to choose, you know, whatever form of higher power you want. You know, my form is Jesus Christ, and you know, this belief in somebody greater than myself allows for me to realize that there is somebody else out there, and even though there's many people and we're surrounded by people, that any one of them can, or all of them can let you down, but there's someone that won't let you down and that will help you through these dark times in your life. And so the 12 steps, several of them address the spiritual well-being, you know, the actual confessing of wrongdoings and shortcomings to another human being is an important part of the process, just as it is, you know, in our everyday world, to the ability to be forgiven. And alcoholics and addicts are, you know, I always tell, if I work with a lot of parents and spouses, and I said, you know, you don't need to beat that person up anymore, because there is no one in the world that thinks worse of himself than that addict. And you know, we get to beating ourselves up so much, and you know, we have fallen short. And I know in my personal case, you know, I had become almost the exact opposite person of the one that I wanted to be, and certainly had looked at, even contemplated suicide, which is part of our disease. And if it wasn't for the spiritual awakening and coming in contact with some people, you know, the chaplains at Valley Hope, and then others after I started participating in AA and NA, Narcotics Anonymous, that could help guide me and see this spirituality that was available to me, and this God that cared for me, didn't care what I did, you know, I'd like to think that Valley Hope's approach to this is similar to Jesus when he was on the earth. You know, he didn't hang out with the high priest and the Pharisees. He was with the prostitutes and the destitutes, and you know, he was forgiving them of their sin and giving them hope. And you know, we're very proud of our name. That Dr. Lynn Collip was very instrumental in the naming of this organization, Valley Hope. And to think of the valley that we end up in as alcoholics and addicts, and then to get just a glimmer of hope, you know, to me, probably the closest to hell on earth is a hopeless state. And that is where alcoholics and addicts go to. And to be given just a little glimmer of hope, we can do so much with that. And to see people that come in that are near death, physically, mentally, and spiritually, and to see a revival, an actual transformation in their life over, you know, a few days is so heartwarming. And you know, we have people that come in that are very sick physically, as I was describing the detox facility, and then, you know, to have other people besides the individual sessions, we also do small groups. And there's a real bond that develops. I know for my time 25 years ago, there's still two or three of the people I was in treatment with that I consider, you know, just dear friend. You form a bond with somebody that has battled the same battle that you have, and to go through and to get on the other side of that with a couple people. And the thing about an alcoholic and addict is that we might, you know, just like me, I was very public, you know, I was in the car business and belonged to all the civic clubs and you know, was involved with sports and all of that. And so you know, I tried to create this image of someone that kind of had it all together, but inside I was a lonely person and, you know, in getting close to a hopeless state. And that's what we find with our addicts. And I'm sure many of our listeners today, the medical doctors and dentists, you know, run into patients, and again, there is hope, whether it's at a Valley Hope facility, and you know, even though we're located in seven states in the Midwest, oftentimes we'll have patients from both coasts and everywhere in between, and You know, and then just another encouraging word, unfortunately, the profession itself, you know, we see the kind of the same percentage of dentists and doctors that come into our facilities that are, you know, afflicted by the disease themselves. So to let them know that it's you know, I was the Secretary of Commerce and you know, the disease was part of my life. And, you know, so it doesn't matter what your background, profession, what socioeconomic status that you have, this disease doesn't discriminate. And, you know, the thing about our facilities and others besides Valley Hope is that, you know, we love you no matter what your profession or what your tilt in life is. And so I wanted to put that in there, too. We actually offer something that we did a lot at the beginning. We would host like Healthcare Week, and we'd have doctors and dentists and other healthcare professionals come and spend a whole week. Well, in today's world, it's hard to, you know, we just got so many things going on. And so we reinstituted Healthcare Day and also Ministerial Days. And so we'll host a group of physicians and other healthcare professionals at our facilities to where they can actually see, you know, and participate in the classes and see the patients and interact. And they find it really eye-opening, you know, because they just don't know. And the same with the ministers that come to our ministerial days.
You know, Pat, it's just wonderful because all of us in healthcare, one, we have the problem because we have access to these, especially drugs. But the other thing is, too, we have, for personal issues that happen, and we have members that have contacted us about that in their own lives or their families' lives. And then secondly, we all have patients that are dealing with this and trying to find a good resource, a Christian resource, a place where people can go and get the help that they need, which you can't do in a 15-minute office visit if you get 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And you know you've got to have something more to offer. So what you're sharing is just so helpful. And give that web information again so people can go and especially find out about the doctor's days and contact information as they're dealing with patients and want to help them or colleagues. We wanted to get this interview on because you guys are a great resource and we want our members to know about it.
Absolutely. And again, that's valleyhope.org. The 800 number is 1-800-544-5101. And one of the doctors I remember in a board meeting a year ago said, you know, I didn't get much training about addiction. And so, you know, I have patients that come in that I suspect that there might be an addiction or alcohol problem. But first of all, I know if I bring up the subject, it'd probably make them mad. And then second of all, I don't really know what to do with them, you know, after, you know, if we do get honest with each other. And so that's the resource we want to provide, is that here's a way, and we're very adept. We work with a number of professional associations across the country and working with whether it's physician groups or attorney groups, you know, to offer this help and to kind of be a link to them. So, you know, they want to do well, and whether it's a patient or a family member or themselves, is that, you know, we're a resource that is available. We've been around 50 years, so we know what we're doing. And, you know, we're a nonprofit charitable organization, so our mission in life is to help as many people as we can.
Pat, thanks for being with us. And thank you for what you're doing and your honesty. There's no better story than your own. You're telling a story as an illustration, and you've been very open with us and the challenges you faced. Thanks for being with us on Christian Doctor's Digest.
Dave, I appreciate it. And again, valleyhope.org if you need any information. And God bless you. And we'll keep praying for you and for all those out there suffering from this disease of addiction.
Boy, there really is an addiction of opioid and other things, meth, you name it, in our country. We're an addicted society. It's one of the reasons I want to put this on. Put a good resource into your hands as you deal with patients that come in with these issues. Let me mention another good resource, Neil Anderson's book, The Bondage Breaker. Over a million of those in print. And it deals with habitual sins and irrational feelings and the things that drive people into addiction. It's a great resource available from our prescriber resource here at CMDA and cmda.org and 888-230-2637 if you'd like to get a copy. If you don't have the prescriber resource app, you need to get that as well. It's a great tool in your practice just to pull up something to suggest to patients as a resource for them to follow up on what you've been talking to them about. If you're like me, it seems it's hard to think that 2017 is just about to end and give way to a new year. 2018 is on its way, but it's true, and this is the time of year which offers us an opportunity to be tax-wise with our planning and our charitable giving as well. So I've asked Jeff Anderson, our Director of Gift Planning, to join me to provide some good year-end tax advice and give you some great ideas. Welcome, Jeff.
Thanks, Dave. It's always great to be with you.
You know, Jeff, 2017 is about to end, and we're hearing a lot of stuff about tax reform. I mean, what kind of guidance can you give people? Are you a prophet?
I'm not a prophet, Dave, and trying to be a prophet regarding Congress and the president would be very difficult. But you're right. We're hearing so much from this Congress and the president, and there seem to be many ideas being floated, quite frankly, as trial balloons, I think, with respect to sweeping changes for our federal tax law. It does remind me of what one of my favorite teachers said to me many years ago. If you love the law and if you love sausage, you probably don't want to see either one being made. And although we don't have that crystal ball or we're not prophets to predict what will be the final bill that may be passed by the Congress and signed by the president, there are certain things each of us can consider for tax-wise planning now in this uncertain environment. First, a time-honored general rule of thumb is to accelerate our charitable giving into this tax year and to defer income, if possible, so that income is recognized in the next tax year.
And so does this rule of thumb have any extra importance with what's going on now?
I think it certainly does, Dave. We need to, in effect, go with what we know. When we examine many of those trial balloons and tax proposals being discussed, there is much talk focused around significantly increasing the standard deduction. While that could result in many of us as taxpayers paying less income tax, the downside to that idea is that by one estimate, this could mean that up to 95% of Americans could lose their ability to itemize deductions on their federal returns and thus be denied a deduction for their charitable giving. So what do we know? What we know is this. The charitable deduction could be much more valuable right now in 2017. So if you itemize on your tax return, you would want to accelerate your charitable gifts for church and ministry to give more this year by December 31st. And should that increased standard deduction become law, and thus possibly decrease the value of the charitable deduction next year for many taxpayers.
You know, this is the time of year when people are thinking about their required minimum distributions from the IRA if they're over, 70 and a half. What advice do you have for them?
Dave, I cannot stress enough to our members the significance of this point. You're right. Generally, our members age 70 and a half and older with an IRA, individual retirement account, need to work with their IRA custodian, and that's usually their bank or credit union or brokerage, to make that required minimum distribution on or before December 31st, or you'll face a significant penalty of 50% of the amount to be distributed as additional penalty to the IRS. And here's something very important for 2017, Dave. Remember, look at the calendar, please. December 31st falls on a Sunday this year, So we need to have our required minimum distributions done no later than Friday, December the 29th. Here's tip number two for charitable giving. If you must take a required minimum distribution this year, please give very strong consideration to using all or part of that required minimum distribution as a charitable IRA rollover for your stewardship. The charitable IRA rollover now has been a permanent feature of the federal tax law for 2 years. And by using your required minimum distribution in this manner, you won't be paying any income tax on that distribution from your IRA. Instead, you'll be supporting your favorite charitable causes, and it's a smart tax-wise move for many of our members.
And that can be done all of the RMD or part of the RMD, depending on your own financial situation.
That is correct.
What about donor-advised funds? I mean, what exactly is that, and is it something that can be funded here at the year-end?
Year-end, Dave, is an excellent time to consider the establishment of a donor-advised fund. A donor-advised fund, or DAF, is a philanthropic vehicle established at a community foundation or an organization such as the National Christian Foundation or brokerages such as Fidelity, Vanguard, or Schwab, for examples. It allows donors to make a charitable contribution, receive an immediate income tax benefit, and then you as the donor would recommend grants to church and charity from your DAF over time. You don't have to direct or give away the money all at once or even in 2017. Rather, you recommend grants from your fund over a period of years. Another way to think of it is this, if I may. We think of a donor-advised fund as much like having your own private family foundation without all the hassle, headache, and expense of managing a private family foundation. So yes, funding a donor-advised fund before December 29th can be a significant and excellent tax-wise move and involve your family in philanthropy for years to come.
Yeah, you can take the tax deduction this year and then decide what you're going to do with the money at a later time.
And isn't that a real flexible way to do your stewardship?
Yeah. Let's get down to the final category. What about just gifts of cash, check, credit cards, stock? Are there any special things people should be thinking about this year?
There are some things to think in this area, Dave. First, if you're giving by check, it must be postmarked by IRS regulations on or before December 31st to count as a charitable gift for tax year 2017. And again, please remember, given that December 31st is on a Sunday this year, we in CMDA stewardship recommend that you mail your check on or before Friday, December 29th, to make sure it's postmarked in time. For credit cards that you mentioned, your card must be charged by the charitable organization on or before December 31st. Many websites, including CMDA's website at cmda.org, will do this on the day you enter that gift by credit card. Now, if you were to mail the gift and say, "Charge my credit card," but the charity charged your credit card on January 2nd when they received that credit card gift in the mail, then you've made a gift, but you've made a gift for 2018 tax year, according to the IRS. And finally, you mentioned gifts of stock. For gifts of appreciated publicly traded stock that you've owned for at least 1 year, your brokerage needs to transfer the stock to CMDA's account or to your church's account on or before, again, that Friday, December 29th, in order for the gift of stock to be a charitable gift for 2017. If you'll contact us, CMDA Stewardship will be very happy to help you and your broker timely transfer that gift of stock, and then we'll provide the paperwork for your tax return.
Thanks, Jeff. This has been so helpful. How can people get a hold of you? They've got other questions or specific situations they need advice on. How to get hold of the Stewardship Department?
Please give us a call, and you can do that call toll-free at 888-230-2637. Or visit us on the web at cmdagift.org, or you may wish to email me at jeff.anderson@cmda.org, or our VP for Stewardship, Jamie Campbell, simply at jamie.campbell@cmda.org. And we're always here, Dave, to help and assist our members and their advisors in the year-end planning, and very happy and blessed to do so.
Jeff, thanks so much. A lot of great advice.
Thanks very much, Dave. Happy Thanksgiving and Merry Christmas.
Being an old missionary and someone who's asked to be an endorsement of new books, I get a lot of mission books and a lot of great ones. Bob Bowers contacted me recently and asked me to look at his first book with Dr. Bob in Ethiopia. And we'll talk about that in the interview. But Bob's got a fascinating career, over 40-plus years working in six different countries in three continents in missions. And he started in Liberia for a short term of 3 years, came back and did his surgery residency. He went to Ethiopia in 1974, was there for 3 years before they had to leave, and you'll hear some of those stories. Came back and did some private practice in the U.S., and then off to Kenya for 11 years, and was the medical director of a large mission hospital there. Back to the U.S. and practiced a little bit more here, then to Zambia, then to Albania, and finally to Bangladesh from 2004 to 2012, where he was the only surgeon for millions of people. He has more interesting stories to tell than you can shake a stick at. And so it's just a real joy to sit down with him not long ago and hear some of those stories, especially about that difficult time in Ethiopia. You'll be inspired. Bob, it's a delight to have an old missionary like you to come and join on Christian Doctor's Digest. When I read your book, I just loved it and wanted to get together and share some of the things about it. It really focuses, doesn't it, on just a short time of your many years of missionary service in Ethiopia. Tell us kind of about what was going on then in the late 70s.
Well, we arrived in Ethiopia in 1974, which was just 2 weeks before Haile Selassie was overthrown. So we arrived in the middle of a Marxist revolution, which just got worse and worse as far as the political situation the longer we were there.
Now, you were down at Soto Hospital, and tell us a little bit about that as a surgeon and out more in the, as we'd say in Africa, in the bush.
Yeah, we started off in Shashamani Hospital and then did our language study and went down to Soto. Soto was the only hospital down there. There was no government hospital or any other medical facility anywhere nearby. So basically, it was only hospital for 3 million people, and I was the only doctor there for 3 million people. So it was an enormous medical load, and a pressure situation.
I put that in context. I think there's one doctor for every 400 people in the United States, and you had 3 million. So you hoped a whole lot of them didn't show up every day. What was work like? I mean, just describe a day, typical day to us. I mean, I know transport's a difficulty. I mean, when people come to the hospital in Africa, they're usually really sick.
Yeah, well, the day would start off with rounds on the patients. It was, I'd say, roughly a 200-bed hospital. I'd say roughly because you put more beds in if you got more patients. Mm-hmm. And then after rounds, I would go do surgery until early afternoon until I got done, and then I would be there in the clinic in the afternoon seeing patients until we finished. So there could be long days. Night call is a big deal if you're the only surgeon.
Yeah.
But the redeeming thing was being in a situation like that where there wasn't electricity and it was hard for people to travel at night, rarely did people come in unless they were really sick during the night. They would wait until the next morning. So getting a good night's sleep most nights was a great help in that situation.
Yeah, yeah. When there's no break, it's really tough. How did you, and we'll get into some of the political stuff, but how do you, I know one of the issues and when we're training new missionaries is talking about them, you know, it's not that you don't have the opportunity to do good. It's when you have competing goods. One good thing is, as a doc, you've got to get away sometime. The downside of that is when you get away, there's nobody at the hospital. How did you handle that type of stress and strain? Because you can't keep going forever, but at the same time, when you're not there, people could die.
It's a problem. We were gone. I was not gone very much. I was there most of the time. I don't remember the exact days. And we had some very competent nurses there who could handle a lot of the things there. But it just came down to the reality of the situation that you couldn't be there 24/7. And have to face the fact that you're human, you're not God, and when you're gone, then you have to just leave it in God's hands as far as when people come.
That is a great way to put it, because some new missionary doctors think they are God, and I have to remind them it's a marathon, it's not a sprint, and if you burn yourself out, there'll be nobody there to help. So talk about the political situation. I mean, that's really, with all the humor and the stories and the great stuff, but the thread that runs through this, as I read the book, I think is God's faithfulness in the midst of a terrible, difficult situation that just continued to escalate. And I'd love to dig into that, because until people read this book, I don't think they can fully imagine, no matter how many stories you tell on this issue, of what it was really like during those Marxist days as things became much more violent and much more unsettled and threats came. Just dig into that story of how God kept you there. I think a lot of people left long before you guys were forced to.
Yeah, well, they were in the middle of a Marxist revolution. And I take it that this was almost a planned thing, because the same thing seemed to happen in every place where the mission had a station or a medical facility at the same time. But it was a progressive thing, that it just started off with a little bit of harassment. And then as time went on, people became more and more agitated and angry, and it was rare to walk at the hospital without people throwing manure or rotten tomatoes at us or calling out curses on us. They came into the hospital once and took a whole bunch of medicine out on the road and burned it publicly, saying we were giving bad medicine. And then there was all of the problem within the hospital of the workers going on strike or refusing to do things, and long meetings where they would accuse me of all sorts of different things. So it was a progressive thing, and it was just a constant harassment. Then there was the factor of when you traveled, being stopped at all these checkpoints, and every building you went into, you had to be frisked and that sort of thing.
And you had young children at that time, including a baby. How did you handle that?
Yeah, our oldest son, Bob, at that time, towards the end, was 9, and our second son was 7, and then we had a 6-month-old baby. Part of it, you just live with it, because that's the way it was. But if you read my book, you'll see that it made me angry and was making me getting very bitter, because, you know, I thought we have gone there and we're doing our best to help people, and the response is not only not appreciation, but aggressively accusing us and trying to make us look bad.
Yeah, yeah. How did God help you? What kind of lessons did he teach you through this process? He doesn't waste our pain, as you know. And, you know, a lot of folks would have just, this started, and they had packed up and headed home. You guys were there for a long time after this started escalating. And how did God help you handle it?
Well, we felt that God had called us there, and so we were committed to stay, if at all possible, just because God doesn't lead you to bail out when things get difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I guess patience was part of what I learned. And towards the end, it was to the point where I felt that maybe God didn't call us to work in Ethiopia because of what we were going to do for him in Ethiopia, but what he was going to do in us and learning us to deal with this in our own lives.
You know, I think, you know, what's going on now, and you're familiar with in American medicine and how some of people listening to this are discouraged. They're not getting harassed like you were, people throwing tomatoes and manure and the risk and taken to the police department and all the things that happened to you all. But I think what you said was so key, Bob, that you have to revisit your call and the idea, I'm not here by chance, I'm not here because I'm doing just humanitarian work, or I just want to help people. I'm here because God called me, and this is my mission field for the day, and he didn't promise it's going to be easy. And I think he's teaching some U.S. docs these days, patience, as he taught you patience back in those days. Tell us how this went forward. I mean, we've kind of got this picture, this escalation starting to happen. It finally came to a crux. Tell us briefly what happened.
Well, as things got worse and worse, it finally came to the point where the national radio, Radio Ethiopia, broadcast to all the nation that Sodu Hospital was giving bad medicine to people and people were dying as a result. And the director of our mission at that point sent a radio message down to us one morning and said, you all have to get out of there right now for your own safety. So this kind of brought everything to an abrupt end.
How many years was that into this, or months?
Well, we were there 3 years, so this was three years into it, or 2.5 years.
Yeah. Talk about that day, because you weren't even sure you're going to be able to leave. I mean, they were not going to block you from leaving.
Yeah, the day, a couple of days before all this happened, I was in the hospital, so I wasn't there, but soldiers came into our house where my wife was and said we were hiding guns, and they bayoneted all the mattresses, saying that they thought we were hiding guns within the mattress, and they bayoneted the mattresses in the crib where our six-month-old was, so that was kind of traumatic. So I got this radio message. I got the message brought to me while I was doing a cesarean section. When I finished, I went home, and I said, Marion, we're leaving right now. And we got in the car, and we left. We left everything. She even left food cooking on the stove. The hospital workers had said they would prevent me from leaving because I was the only doctor. But they were all away on their lunch break, so they didn't block us. And I went down to the police station to check out, and usually they want to check all your stuff, and it's a big hassle, and they just said we should go on. On the way out of town, we passed the governor, who 2 weeks before had said under no circumstance would he let me leave. So I stopped and said, we're leaving. And he said, if you want to leave, leave. And there we were in a situation that I thought would be all afternoon or 2 or 3 days getting out. There we were in a half hour, free and on our way to Addis. And we found out what happened several weeks later when Marion's sister, Charlotte, met us at the airport in New York City and said, I was awakened at 4 a.m. on such and such a morning to pray for your safety. And she thought, I think they're already safe. Why should I get up at 4 a.m. and pray? But the urging was so strong that she prayed for us from 4 to 5 a.m. And she said, did anything happen? And we went back and compared dates and times, and 4 to 5 a.m. her time was 12 to 1 when we were driving away from Sodu. So the effectual fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much, as it says in James.
Yeah. Yep. My mother had a little women's prayer group that met and prayed for us. And I remember saying to her after we get back, when I was doing relief work and going to war zones and every stuff, I said, if I knew those women were praying, I'd go anywhere. So it's
amen.
It's very much the truth. You sense that and you live in the presence of God. You guys, that wasn't the end of the story. That's towards the end of the book. But you guys went on to serve other places and a whole missionary career. Just briefly tell that. I mean, for a lot of folks, they'd say, wow, you know, that was so bad. We're back to the U.S. and that's it. And you guys, God used you for a whole career all across Africa.
Yeah, we were in Kenya, Kajabi Hospital, not far from where you were working.
Right.
We were there for 11 years, and then we spent a year as a furlough replacement in Zambia and a year in Albania where Marion taught in a missionary children's school. And then the last 8 years, we've been in Bangladesh.
Wow. What a career of God using you guys to transform bodies and transform lives. I just say, Bob, as we close this out, that I really want to encourage people to get this book. I get lots of books sent to me to read, and I picked up your book and started reading it and stayed up until I finished it.
Wow.
It was that good. And that night, in fact, we were driving somewhere, and Jody was driving, and I was reading. And I would say, wait a minute, stop. She was listening to a sermon on her iPhone. And I'd say, can you turn it off for a second? I got to read this to you. And she'd laugh, or I'd laugh, or we get this poignant story. It's just, Bob, you did a wonderful job putting this down on paper based on your letters home. And it's just like you're there. And I encourage people to get a copy of the book. It'll impact your life and impact the lives of others that you share it with. But it's just a wonderful chronicle of God's grace in a very difficult situation, and just a blessing to me. So I want to thank you for your faithfulness of putting this down, and I'm just trusting it's going to have a great impact around the world as people read the stories that are there.
Well, thank you.
Well, I don't think I need to say any more about the book after the end of that interview. I mean, this is one of the best mission books I've read. And I encourage you to get a copy. We have it here at CMDA. Give us a call at 888-230-2637. Don't let your spouse read it first if you're married, because you won't get it back for a while. Read it first yourself and start sharing it with others. Encourage them to purchase it as well. You also go on the web, cmda.org, and go to our resource area. It's available there. It just takes minutes to order it that way. But this is a book you really need to read. You know, it's getting that time of year when we start thinking about buying Christmas gifts, and it's always, I don't have enough time, and what do I get for colleagues and family? And, you know, we got a great idea for you this year. It's my new book called Servant Leadership, and over 900 proverbs taking servant leadership principles and putting into very compact and pithy quotes that are easy to remember and to apply. This comes boxed. It's in a blue leatherette cover. You can inscribe their name on it, and it all comes for under $20. Where else are you going to find a gift like that that people will keep forever for that price? If you'd like to purchase one or more of these, in fact, they're discounts if you purchase them in quantities, just go to cmda.org/servant leadership or give us a call at 888-230-2637. Do you know, when we talk about potlucks, we've got a potluck of conferences, a lot of delicious dishes to sample. In fact, CMDA does over 41 conferences a year. We do that so there's something close to you, something that you're interested in on a wide variety of topics. Let me give you some that are coming up after the first of the year. In January 19th through the 21st, Marriage Enrichment Weekend, Palm Coast, Florida. And it's for female physicians and their spouses only. So if you're a female doctor, this is a great time to get away and enrich your marriage. And for those of you that would like to get away in February, where it's nice and warm, go to Albuquerque, New Mexico, February 23rd to 25th for another Marriage Enrichment. And then come join us here at CMDA. We'd love to shake your hand and welcome you to your house, our headquarters, for the CMDA's winter conference. And the speaker this year is Dr. Al Weir. Many of you get his devotions and know how well he can write and speak and inspire you and equip you for what you're needing to do. And this year, the topic is the 12 steps to Christian decision making. Finding God's direction for life decisions. Bring a student, bring a resident, spend the weekends to sit in front of the fireplace with us. Have a cup of hot chocolate or coffee. We're going to have a wonderful time together. And then in March, join us in Orlando, Florida for the first Remedy Conference, March 23 and 24. That's a Friday and Saturday at First Baptist Church, Orlando. Now, many of you have been to the Global Missions Health Conference. It's had a tremendous impact, over 3,000 in attendance. But we know, looking at the demographics, that most people come within a 4 to 6 hour drive, especially students and residents. And so we're starting another mission conference. It's called Remedy because that's easier to remember. I really hope you'll come and bring a resident and a student, especially if you're in the Southeast, or load up a van load of them. And we're going to have free housing for students and missionaries and residents. And it's going to be a great time of focusing on the Great Commission with inspirational speakers, great breakout sessions, wonderful networking. You'll see many of your friends, and it's just going to be a great time. If you'd like to get more information, just go to cmda.org/remedy, and you can register online. And then in April 26th through the 29th, CMDA's national meeting, where we focus on transformation. It's going to be, again, at Ridgecrest Conference Center as the trees are beginning to get their leaves and the flowers are blooming and spring is coming. It'd be great to be in the Blue Ridge Mountains, and it's one of my favorite meetings of the year. God does so many good things there. And all you got to do is go online to cmda.org, and you can register for that conference.
We hope to see you at one of these conferences. You know, you need this. I know you're too busy, but you're too busy not to get away, to be restored, to be renewed, to be transformed. So plan this year to get to 2 or 3 CMDA conferences. You'll be blessed. Well, I don't feel like John Patrick needs any introduction, but, you know, it's interesting as I look at some of his information. It's about his medical career and associate professor in clinical nutrition and development and at the University of Ottawa and his medical training in London and work in the West Indies and research. And but you know how we know John Patrick is an apologist, and he has equipped us, challenged us, and given us things to think about for 20 years, more than 20 years at CMDA. And then we're going to have John Robson with us. He's been in the media his whole life. He's a columnist. He's an invited professor at the University of Ottawa. He's a broadcaster on News Talk Radio in Canada, a blogger, a part-time internet entrepreneurial. He's got a very impressive resume, a BA and an MA in history from the University of Toronto, a PhD in American history from the University of Texas. But he's joining us to talk about his spiritual journey to Christ. He's got a fascinating story. John, you wrote me a note saying, let's do something different this time. And you actually want to bring one of your friends on to Christian Doctors Digest to talk about the topic of how to effectively present the good news of Jesus to intelligent unbelievers. And that friend's John Robinson. He's with us. Robinson, I've got to get saying that right without the I in it. John Robinson, tell us a little bit of your story.
My story begins with an upbringing from very firmly atheist Protestants. And I use the phrase advisedly because my parents were non-believers, but they both rejected the Protestant tradition. And that was the one that I grew up being familiar with. To me, the Bible was the King James Bible, and it was a great work of English literature and important in understanding cultural history, but obviously it was a set of fairy tales, and mankind had evolved. We were material creatures. We didn't have souls. There was no afterlife, and like a great many people, my parents were a lot better than this philosophy. They did believe in morality, and they were very good and loving parents. But from a philosophical point of view, they were bleak nihilists. And I grew up accepting this picture of the universe without liking it very much. I read the Narnia Chronicles as a kid. They were slipped to me by a very religious grandmother. And I enjoyed them enormously and wished they were true. But it seemed to me that this was simply not possible. And on it went through early adulthood. And then it began with a long dark night of the soul. I was working very hard at a job that I very much enjoyed, but my days were filled with toil and I was always behind, and I would get home and snatch a few minutes of pleasure, this sort of materialist, hedonist sort of life, where I'd have a nightcap, go to bed, read something I wanted to read, and then fall asleep. And then it hit me very, very hard that the minutes were slipping by. It wasn't just that I wasn't getting enough of these wonderful moments. It was that they weren't really connected to one another. A moment of pleasure you couldn't enjoy before it arrived. When it arrived, it was gone in a quarter of a second. And I suddenly would find myself staring into the materialist abyss and realizing that the vision of myself that I had always accepted was this bag of chemicals whose behavior was driven by the inexorable logic of the laws of physics and chemistry. What I did next was determined by a mathematical calculation of the existing state of the molecules and the particles and the electrical charges. And therefore that even my thoughts were not the connected and coherent behavior of a mind in control of its own environment, making decisions and assessing things, but simply this epiphenomenon from all these chemicals bubbling away and electrical reactions crackling, which of course was a hideous vision essentially of non-existence. As C.S. Lewis once put it, after his wife died, you know, if she is not, If her soul has not survived death, then she never really existed, and I mistook a cloud of atoms for a human being. And once I came through that night and started thinking, well, I know this isn't true. I know that I exist. I know that I persist through time. I know it matters what I do, that there's a coherent moral connection between the past and the future, which, again, is something that most atheists actually believe. I started looking again at the evidence. And this is how I ended up meeting John Patrick, is because of a column that I wrote, which was called Why Taking History Seriously Can Make You Very Cross, in which I challenged others, as I challenged myself, to look afresh at the New Testament. We're so used to it. Everybody's used to it. It's so familiar, not just Christians, but non-believers in Western cultures. Oh, yeah, that's that book full of the fairy stories about Jesus that you had to pretend to believe or else your parents or the church would beat you. And that's how they would dismiss it. And I said, well, hang on. Let's treat this as a historical document. I am, by training, a historian. That's what I was doing professionally. It's the background of my journalism and my documentaries. And I said, we have these writings that come down to us from actually very early in the first century. We now know they were not written 200 or 300 years later. What are they? They purport to be eyewitness accounts of basically incredible events that happened in the first century in the eastern end of the Mediterranean. But let's look at these as historical documents and ask ourselves, how can we account for these things? Again, C.S. Lewis says about Jesus, a lot of people will say, well, Jesus was a great moral teacher. Of course, he wasn't a son of God or any of that superstitious nonsense, but he told us a lot of good things about how we should live. And Lewis says, no, that's the one thing you can't say about Christ, because he does expressly claim divinity. So he's either a liar, a lunatic, or the Lord. But of course, the modern non-believer cannot go up to Jesus and say, excuse me, I'd like to check you out on this one, because he's not accessible in the way that your next-door neighbor or your annoying brother-in-law is. But the gospel, I transfer the question to the gospels, because they are available. You can pick up the New Testament, you can look at it. It is a faithful copy going back to handwritten documents that seem probably to have been recorded in some form or another during the life of some of the disciples, and certainly of St. Paul, obviously, the letters he wrote. And I ask, are these lies? Does the New Testament consist of a series of cunningly devised fables, as Peter puts it, at least in the King James Version? Does the Sermon on the Mount read like a lie? And if it's a lie, what's the purpose of it? I can understand an elaborate fraud in order to get money or power or something like that, but in order to get crucified upside down, it doesn't seem logical that a bunch of clever, dishonest men and women would conjure this story up in order to be shunned by their neighbors, stoned to death, and otherwise persecuted and killed. But if they're not lies, are they lunacy? When you hold the gospel in your hand, and we've all had experiences with various forms of mental instability or outright craziness in our lives, do we feel that the New Testament is another example of that? Is the Sermon on the Mount madness on the part either of the speaker or of the scribe? It contains much that is baffling and challenging, but it's not the rantings of a madman. And if it were, how would it have convinced all these people? Because Christians were persecuted right from the word go. They were shunned, they were scorned, they were feared, they were mocked, and yet the message continued to spread. And if we look at the Gospels from that point of view and we say, they're not a forgery, they're not deliberate deceit, and there are all kinds of reasons for thinking they're not, including that they didn't take pains to remove some of the inconsistencies that non-believers have jeered at down through the years. If you were forging these things, you'd made sure the story was matched exactly, and they don't. But they're also not lunacy. What does that leave? And what it leaves is the otherwise staggering possibility, but the most empirically sound one, which is that these really are eyewitness accounts, with all the frailties of human eyewitness accounts that one finds everywhere, including the court of law, but they are eyewitness accounts of events that were so incredible that the people who saw them and wrote them down could scarcely believe them, but that really did happen. And as Paul says in 1 Corinthians, he admits that this is, you know, foolishness to the Greeks and a stumbling block to the Jews, but then he says, but he was seen by hundreds of people, most of whom are still alive. In short, if you don't believe what I'm saying, go ask these people because they saw the risen Christ. And again, we can't do that today, obviously. These people are now, they've been dead for 1900 years. But at the time, this was an appeal to, not to credulity or superstition, but for skeptics to check the empirical record. And so my column and my standing challenge to people in the modern world or invitation, you are empirically driven, you are skeptics, you like evidence-based decision-making, well, look at the Gospels and the fact that they persuaded the most cosmopolitan society that the ancient world had ever seen. The Romans were not a bunch of yokels. It's not like they didn't know where babies came from, or the Jews. I mean, that's why the story of the virgin birth is so incredible. When Joseph finds out that his wife is pregnant, his first thought is that it happened the obvious way. These people were not hicks. And yet they were convinced by this otherwise preposterous story about a dead Jewish carpenter being God. The only way this could really have happened is if there was convincing evidence that overcame the obvious inherent skepticism as well as the political and religious hostility of the authorities to this claim.
Wow. John, you're not just a journalist, you're a preacher. That's pretty good sermon. So let's get down to the crux of the matter then. How do you effectively present the good news of Jesus to intelligent unbelievers? And our members have colleagues and friends that would fit that category, who many do not know Christ. Let's go back to John Patrick for a moment, and I'll come back to you, John.
Well, this is beautiful because, first of all, I have a totally different memory of how we got to meet for the first time. But that, as he said, the gospel writers couldn't remember exactly a rite all the while. They didn't always agree with one another. But I think I met John first in a little lunchtime meeting, which was arranged by one of the few Christian journalists in Ottawa at the National Press Club. And then we had lunch together a few times. John was an atheist at that point, but he was open to argument, and I enjoyed that. And then he wrote this wonderful column, which I'm sure you've got a copy of now.
I do, yes.
You can send out to your many folk out there. But what interested me and made me want to get him along at this time, things changed over the years. And two or three years back, I asked John to take part in our summer program at Augustine for physicians. The physicians, by the way, love this guy. And I asked him because we were at the time of Magna Carta, and he's made a DVD on Magna Carta and freedom of speech and freedom of the freedoms that matter to the Western society. And I asked him the first time he came, how do I introduce you? And he didn't really wish to be named as a Christian. But he came again last year, and he admitted that he's now, as I knew from his column, willing to be labeled. Now, I suspect that like Lewis, yes, he made the move from atheism to theism on a rational basis, but Christ coming to life in our lives, we can't explain that. And I don't think John can explain how he made that move either. But I'd be interested to see what his comment was, because I think we would do much better as Christians in the modern world saying to the atheist and the nothings, you can't understand what I'm talking about, and I can't make you understand. Only God can do that, but he will do if you search. But John, what do you say?
Well, yeah, I would have said when we met, I was not an atheist. I was a militant agnostic. I concluded that the question was insoluble.
A distinction and, without a difference, yeah.
But what happened, you see, in a way, and I agree, you know, you can't make people understand. It's like the dwarves at the very end of the last battle who will not open their eyes and see that they're in Aslan's country. But you see, what happened to me is that the materialist foundation on which I stood collapsed horrifyingly under my feet. Partly, I've been reading G.K. Chesterton because he made such appropriate, these great bon mots about current events. But you have, as Lewis said, atheists have to be careful what they read. And so it was partly, I think, reading Chesterton, comparing what he was saying with my life. But it's when I realized that the materialist vision of oneself, essentially a series of unconnected tiny slices of time, that the idea of the self persisting even for 4 or 5 seconds, let alone over a period of years, is in the materialist vision, that simply can't happen. You're just a set of chemical reactions which are connected by the laws of physics, not the laws of metaphysics, and by biochemistry, not by morality. And so if you see a man beating a child to death in the street and you do nothing, from the materialist point of view, the you who did nothing 5 minutes later has no connection with that incident that should cause you to feel guilt or shame. And one of the funny things, of course, about materialists is that they account for all their emotions as a trick of the genes. All my thoughts, all my impulses, they're not real, and then they act on them anyway. I mean, I've known people who would argue passionately that there was no truth, and they would not give in. What does it matter to you? But again, it's just determined. So the materialist vision is unsustainable, I think. It is simply because we know that we exist. We know that we have moral responsibilities. So I think one of the ways you approach it is to say to people, well, you know there's right and wrong. You know that certain, we may even disagree about what's right and wrong, but you know there are things that are right, and you know that there are things that are wrong, and you know we have to try to do right things. Well, how do you know that? And how can that be true? How is it possible that certain things are just wrong? Even if the law doesn't say they're wrong, we know they're wrong. The laws in Nazi Germany can say it's okay to kill Jews, but we know in our hearts that it's wrong. How can there be a moral agent inside you? How can there be a ghost in the machine? Because you know there is one. You experience it yourself every day. Many atheists are passionately devoted to all manner of causes across the political spectrum. How can it matter what we do? You believe that we're just bags of meat following instructions that make us likely to pass on our DNA, and yet you don't act like you thought that. You can't act like you thought that. Something inside you prevents you from doing that. Well, what is it? How do you explain that? Because if you can show them that their views are not rational, because the big knock on Christianity is that it's irrational, that Christians are stupid and fearful people clinging to God and guns, as an American president once put it. And as I say about all kinds of political debates, if people think you're a clown, don't show up in a fright wig. So you challenge the moderns by showing them that what they're doing and thinking doesn't fit their own self-understanding. And you do it with a friendly smile, and you won't expect to reach everybody. And of course, there are all kinds of reasons not to want to be a Christian, including that it will place rather severe demands on you if you really accept it. And John points out, at first, you know, I was reluctant to be identified as a Christian, partly because of people's reaction, say, I'm a Christian and slam. But also, I was afraid of being mocked. And then I thought one day, this is the most important thing about me. If I deny him before men, I understand what the consequences will be, and I just have to be willing to do it. And in fact, they haven't been unpleasant, but if they had been, it wouldn't matter. So, you know, there are people who are going to smell a rat the minute you start down this path. And you won't be able to reach them, at least not now. But God moves in mysterious ways, and we must respect that. But I say you challenge them, you meet them where they are. You say, empirically, there's right and wrong. But the materialist universe cannot contain these things. Therefore, the materialist explanation has something very major wrong with it. And you can't make it go away. You can't shut off your conscience. Therefore, it's real. Right and wrong are real, your knowledge of them is real, and as a rational, self-respecting person, you need a theory of the universe that can account for the fact that right and wrong are enormously powerful and very plain.
John Patrick, how would you respond to that?
I would say amen. I mean, all the way. I mean, there's a lot of interesting things happening, which I hope your members, my brothers and sisters, are noting. And I'll interject them at this point. One is a phenomenon in Canada about a guy called Jordan Peterson, worth watching. A professor of psychology at the University of Toronto, who has been thinking about these things apparently for quite a long while, but not saying anything that would cause him any trouble. So he had big grants from the Social Sciences Research Council, who don't like Christians. He's a psychologist. Most academic psychologists are atheists. But what got to him was that the students were empty and meaningless, and that the nonsense about gender, choosing your own pronouns, choosing your own gender, got to him, and he said, I won't do it. And he took a lot of flack. He lost his grants, but he went on some sort of fundraising organization, John will know what it was, and he got the money, came back overnight, and he has hundreds of thousands of people watching his videos, and he's become a phenomenon. And he's very much on our side in terms of pre-evangelism. And I think it's pre-evangelism we need to focus on, which is what John was talking about just now. what do you need to believe to hold the position you currently hold, that there is no God, and still have the world that you know you really want? They can't do that. And he knows that. He's not yet explicitly Christian, but he can't avoid it in the long run, I think. He's a bit like Dalrymple, who's, I can't understand why he hasn't crossed the borderline either, but these people are there, and they're being honest. And in the Christian area, the thing that's amazed me over the last little while is the huge growth in interest in apologetics. Now, if I give a talk for CMDA or for CMDS or Christian organizations in general, I might get 100 people. But if you do one on apologetics, you'll get 500 or 1,000. And they'll be Christians. The first time I was asked to do this, I was taken by surprise because I went to a little place in the Fraser Valley and I thought there'd be 100 people on a Saturday morning and there were 1,500. And some of them had driven from Montana to be there for this conference. I wasn't the only speaker. And it was on apologetics. The younger generation want answers, but they don't want to be taken for another emotional ride. They want real content. Give them real content. And that's what the college does, too.
Yeah.
We don't evangelize at all. We just tell them how to tell the story, and they go off to university, and they can take their colleagues on. I think my shorthand would be, as evangelicals, we think where we should feel, and we feel where we should think. We don't know how Christ brings us into his kingdom. We know we're given a choice. We say yes, and we know something has happened. It's not objective in our modern world. It's objective internally. But then when we go to church on Sunday morning, instead of doing what the New Testament tells us to do, which is to think carefully, which is usually going to make you feel terrible until you confess, repent, and move on, we want to feel good. So we have feel-good Sunday mornings, and we have this is the argument sign here, you're a Christian evangelism. Those are the wrong way around.
Yeah. John Robson, tell me how your life changed when all this happened. Sorry, I interrupted you. Maybe you...
That's my sermon for the day, so to speak. You're talking to John Robson at that
point,
huh?
Yes.
In many respects, I would say that my life didn't change. I've been very busy with a lot of things that I'm still very busy with. But I think two things happened. I would say one was this kind of internal feel-good thing, which has happened to me a number of times in my life when I've adopted a view that I thought would prove unpopular, would see me shunned, and would be dragging it around like Jacob Marley's chain. And instead I felt lighter. I felt that I had removed a burden from my life, the effort not to follow some thoughts where they really needed to follow. And I would say the second thing is just and this doesn't come easily to me. Remember Bob Hope said, humility, I'll pass, you know, and I say, but the thing about humility is that I've heard that it's good, but I really don't have any firsthand experience of what it might be like. but there has been a bit of an ability to be more pleasant to other people because I recognize that not only do I have more failings than I would like to think, but that my failings are no more excusable than other people's just because they happen to be mine. You know, it's like when you, if you play golf, which I don't advise, you know, you hit three or four good shots in a round and you think, that's the real me. And you hit 70 or 80 bad or, you know, pathetic shots and think, there's something else happened. So I've been more inclined to look at my own decisions and behavior in that way and realize that the best shots are not the real me and the bad ones the consequence of wind or uneven ground. And I think that probably has made me a little bit less obnoxious. You'd have to ask the people around me that might say otherwise.
John Patrick, you want to comment on that? Is the other John here less obnoxious? That's
a rip. We could argue as to who is the most obnoxious of the two of us.
That's why you all get along so well together, right?
I think from the beginning we enjoyed the fact that we were interested in the argument and we didn't really care what was said.
Yeah. Yeah,
which
well,
is
that
what a university again, should be like.
Yeah,
and C.S. Lewis again says, you know, that I tend not to judge very harshly those sins to which I am not attracted, but certainly I think the other John and I are similar enough that I understand much of his virtues and of the few drawbacks that he's occasionally exhibited.
This has been delightful. Listen, guys, I want to thank you for spending some time with us, and definitely want to mention Augustine College and thank John Patrick for the tremendous impact that's had. And John Robson, we got to get you back on and hear some more of this. You've been a delight to get to know and hear more about your journey would be wonderful. So thank you for
taking... Anybody wanting a CMDA after dinner speaker, he's very good.
Yeah, I you don't have to convince me of that. You don't have to convince me of that. May God bless both you guys, and look forward to the next time we get together.
Great. Thank you.
If you'd like to keep up with both of these guys, they have great websites where you can do that. John Robson, RobsonCA, johnrobson.ca. And you can follow him online. And, of course, johnpatrick.ca. You can follow him as well. And then we've got some great resources when you're traveling and you want to your mind stimulated on those long trips. Get The Best of John Patrick, Volume 1 or Volume 2. These are CD sets, and they've got John's best talks. And, you know, as you know, if you've heard John, you can't absorb it all on one pass or two passes or three passes. You need to get back into it and remember all the insights he's given. And then I encourage you to also think about, as a gift for someone who is an intelligent unbeliever, Dick Swenson's book, More Than Meets the Eye. I think that's a great book to pass off a lot of scientific insights on proving God and just great apologetics as well. And all that's available here at CMDA at 888-230-2637 or just go online at cmda.org. Are you wondering what to get your colleagues for Christmas? Have I got something for you? The cost is actually zero and the benefit is out of this world. You know, physicians are facing so many challenges in healthcare. In fact, a recent survey showed that the majority of physicians are dissatisfied with their careers, about half are seeking a change, and many are telling their children, don't go into healthcare. That's how bad it is. And yet, when we look at CMDA members, over 80% are very satisfied with their careers. And I think it's because they see this as a calling. They see this as ministry. And despite the obstacles, they know that God goes with them. And this is a great opportunity during these difficult days in healthcare to minister for Christ. And so, how do you encourage your colleagues that are discouraged? Well, one way is to get them to be part of CMDA. And I know you've probably told many of them, well, it's a great organization. You need to do this. And they just never get around to it. Well, we've got a way this year that you can give a Christmas gift of 6 months of membership in CMDA. There's no cost involved. All you've got to do is look at that email or mail you're going to get describing this program. Or if you're anxious to go ahead and get started with it, go to Membership Services, toll-free number, 888-230-2637. Make a list of your colleagues with their contact information, and they will help you do this. It'll go in your name as a gift to them from you about an organization you believe in, an organization that you're part of. What a wonderful way to bless them, and I encourage you to do that. You know, the end of the year, too, is a very important time for us as we try to balance our budget. A large portion of our yearly budget comes in actually during the end of the year. I want to encourage you to give a generous gift. You know, there's no other ministry like CMDA. In fact, this weekend I was up in Michigan speaking at a mission conference, and the first night I talked about CMDA. Why? Because this little church of 130 people supports us every month. That's how dedicated they are. And they were so excited to hear about the ministries. In fact, the pastor came up to me and said, I had no idea you were doing such a wide range of things. And we're going to pray even harder and going to try to give more to help this ministry go forward because I see how critical it is. As we do so much in missions and raising up the next generation, training new missionaries, networking our missionary members, you can be part of that. It's something you don't have time to do. As we speak out on bioethics, just this week, we were dealing with one of the national hospice groups that's considering to take a, quote, neutral position on physician-assisted suicide, and got members to bombard them with letters of concern. And I'll be talking to the CEO in a couple days, who's calling me to talk about this because they got the message. Or I was going over a paper that Jonathan Imbody wrote in Washington, giving feedback on Health and Human Services plan for that department directly to the Secretary of HHS, and giving them ideas of things that we'd like them to do, and telling them how much we appreciate the good things they have in their plan on protecting life, and talking about human trafficking and educating doctors and all sorts of things. You cannot do this alone, but together we can do it. And then bringing up the next generation of Christian doctors, that's what's going to change healthcare. 282 campuses now, 15,000 students in CMDA events each week, and going on mission trips and having their lives transformed. I wish you could read their testimonies as I do every month. They filter up from the campuses of how their lives are being changed, how they say, I couldn't do this if it wasn't for CMDA meetings encouraging me and friends to pray with and growing in my faith and integrating healthcare into my spiritual walk. And what does it look like to be a Christian doctor? You're doing all this and much, much more, bringing people to Christ, over 6,000 through Global Health Outreach this year. Lots on campuses and in communities and around the world through grace prescriptions that people are coming to Christ. You are doing this and so much more. So as we go towards the end of the year, be generous. Ask what God wants you to do. You're pretty much the only ones that are going to support us. That little mission conference in that church in Michigan is pretty unusual, but this is your organization and we are your ambassadors. Give generously and we'll be able to do even more. So as you go into this wonderful time of the year of thanking God for his faithfulness and also celebrating his birth, we pray it'll be a wonderful time of restoration with your family and a time of glorifying Christ and coming closer to him. Until we get a chance to talk again in the new year, may God bless you richly.
Christian Doctors Digest is a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on Christian Doctors Digest are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on Christian Doctors Digest reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.